Hello and welcome to the UCC School of Law podcast, where we showcase the intellectually ambitious research being undertaken by our faculty and discuss topics relevant to each of our internationally recognized research centers. I'm Dr. Björn Oliver Maxig, Program Director of the LLM Marine and Maritime Law here at UCC and a member of our Center for Law and the Environment. On this episode, I'll be speaking with Captain Brian Fitzgerald of the Irish Naval Service. Captain Fitzgerald is the Operations Branch Commander of the Irish Naval Service and commanded the Ariadne during the humanitarian crisis in the Mediterranean. Under his command, the crew of the Ariadne rescued 1,500 people and assisted in the rescue of several thousands more during a 60-day mission in 2017. Brian is also a graduate of the LLM Marine and Maritime Law here at UCC. Welcome to the UCC School of Law podcast. First up, can you describe what your current role entails?
Thank you, Björn. The Irish Naval Service is the state's principal seagoing agency. And what that means is it is required by the state to contribute to the maximum to all of the state's requirements in the maritime domain. Now, that's a very significant policy requirement. But it's extremely significant when you understand the enormity and the rich and diverse nature of Ireland's maritime jurisdiction and Ireland's maritime interests. And first up, one of the biggest challenges that I have in my current role is that although Ireland is on an island, I would argue that very few Irish people think like islanders and appreciate the importance, the value, the opportunity that the seas that we own and have jurisdiction over can deliver for this state. And therefore, I oversee the operational end of the Navy, which is really making sure that I can place ships and law enforcement officers in the right place at the right time to deliver on their law enforcement role on behalf of the state.
Given the responsibilities of your role and the complex nature, as you already discussed a bit, of the operations undertaken by the Naval Service, how has your role evolved in recent years?
I think the biggest evolution that the Naval Service has experienced in recent years has been the jurisdictional advancements that the state has engaged. So, the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, oftentimes seen as the Constitution of the Oceans, really came into force internationally in 1982. So therefore, it was only after that time that people, we'll say, moved their jurisdictional claims further and further out to sea. So when the Irish Navy was incepted, for example, in 1946, the extent of Ireland's jurisdiction was just 3 miles off the coast, which was set by the distance of a cannonball shot. But over time, it evolved to 6 miles and 12 miles. And there it settled until after the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, where an exclusive economic zone came in that set our jurisdiction for several areas out to 200 miles off the coast. This had a massive effect on Ireland, its naval service, and the roles and responsibilities that Ireland had to proceed out there and enforce the law in terms of Ireland's interests. Mm. But even since then, since the year 2000, Ireland has lodged a claim with the continental shelf limits towards our extended continental shelf. So now we have jurisdictional interest that extends over 600 miles west of Ireland. I would sum this up by saying that Ireland, our maritime jurisdiction is in excess of 10 times the size of our landmass, and that we have one of the biggest sea-to-land ratios in the entirety of the European Union.
Yep.
And I'll just finish by saying one thing extra. I say one of the biggest, but in terms of the richness of the resource that's there, because we have a continental shelf, the continental shelf is crucial because life exists on a continental shelf and that life is accessible in that light itself penetrates the sea down to 200, 300 meters. Therefore, that's where the fish are. We have an incredible wind and wave energy regime, and technological advancements has allowed humankind, to reach out into the sea much further than heretofore, in terms of the type of craft that are out there, in terms of the type of exploitation of resources that is out there. And so we've gone from a very quiet, out of sight, out of mind, jurisdictional space to an extraordinarily active and opportune area in an incredible regime that is rich and vast in terms of resources. And this realization, in terms of curing sea blindness in Ireland, manifests in the naval service having this range of maritime defence and security operational roles that it needs to fulfil.
When focusing on the Mediterranean crisis, so missions like Operation Sophia demonstrated the capabilities of the naval service to both international and domestic audiences. As the operations branch commander, how disappointing was it for you to hear that the mission was being scaled back?
Yes, as the operations commander, I have to say it was very disappointing to see the operation scaled back. Of course, as a operations commander of the naval service, I follow government policy, and whatever the government tasking is, we seek to fulfil that to the best of our ability. But in terms of the experience, the rewards, the making a difference feeling, the representing Ireland cheek by jowl with the first world navies in foreign waters, in international waters, understanding a range of nuances between all sorts of law, from humanitarian to maritime security to jurisdiction to border control, and at the heart of it, to be able to make a difference in terms of saving people's lives, perhaps one of the most noble things that one can do. The reward return from that for all of the sailors of the Irish Navy involved in this mission was quite extraordinary, and I don't think it had ever been achieved in such a mass number, such a critical mass, over such a sustained period of time. And in that, it proved Ireland's ability through its navy to contribute cheek by jowl with the first world navies in the height of the public eye. It was quite an extraordinary time. So the loss of that is very much felt.
Yeah.
However, there are other missions. There are other areas that Ireland can contribute. The Irish Naval Service has proven its ability now to contribute. And whether there is a re-escalation of the situation in the Mediterranean and an ability for Ireland to contribute again remains to be seen, or perhaps for the Irish Navy to contribute elsewhere. I certainly believe we have proven our worth as a result of our performance in that mission today.
Absolutely. When you're operating alongside international partners or as part of a multinational force even, such as that deployed in the Mediterranean, having a detailed knowledge of marine and maritime law must have been an advantage.
Having a detailed knowledge of marine and maritime law was an extraordinary advantage. This is a heavily legalized environment, and you have to thread a very, very careful line in terms of law enforcement and your duties under international law when out there. And what you're faced with is, it really is an extraordinary context. It's very difficult to explain, but I'll endeavour to do so. At the heart of this is the ultimate role of saving people's lives. So, regardless of how the people got there in the first instance, there's a lot of discussion can be had about that. People suddenly found themselves in tremendous numbers in international waters, in other words, on the high seas, giving a challenge, I think, to the international community to come up with an appropriate response. And the international law environment that exists and pertains out there was indeed challenged and remains challenged, because the idea of the responsibility and the international legal requirement to save lives at sea under the various conventions were perhaps designed for once-off incidents.
Yeah.
But you have those laws faced with a massive influx of people on the high seas presented an altogether different challenge. And it caused states to react. And it created a tension. Now, there's two tensions here. One of them I would describe as, and it's important, I think, to understand this, and this is what the LLM really brings out in you. There are various jurisdictions at sea. So let's start with the high seas, which is the furthest away from shore, and out there is based on, ever since Hugo Grotius's requirement of or thesis of Mare Liberum versus Mare Clausum, which is the freedom of the seas versus closed seas, open seas versus closed seas, as of today, out on the high seas, freedoms to operate exist beyond jurisdiction. And therefore the jurisdiction that exists out there rests with the flag state, the state under which the vessel is flying its flag. However, the more you move towards the coast, your freedoms overlap with a counter-eminence of coastal state jurisdiction reaching out into the sea. And it gets grey in between. So that's the first area that you could imagine tensions may emerge. The second is the challenge to obey your international obligations, legal obligations, to save lives at sea versus the legal entitlement of coastal states to defend their borders against non-national. And so we were on a ship sitting in between these tensions, dealing with several jurisdictional challenges, several legal challenges, under the scrutiny of the world's media at every hand's turn. Because this is another phenomenon that we now have, is these areas that I mentioned earlier as being out of sight, out of mind, and over the horizon, yeah, are now center in terms of technological reach to be able to see and pry into what is actually going on. So you were basically being judged at every moment in terms of your decisions. So this gave us extraordinary experience. And I'm very proud to say that the Irish Naval Service, probably because of its huge experience in law enforcement at home in domestic waters to do with fisheries, maritime interdiction in terms of drugs, pollution control, and generally policing our seas, was able to handle itself with some of the best and seen First World Navies at every hand's turn and thread the line very, very carefully. And so it resulted in extraordinary number of rescues, in excess of 18,000 by the Irish Navy over a 3-year period.
Yeah. You talked about the legal tensions between some principles. So obviously you throw in politics, which featured heavily and still feature heavily in the Mediterranean crisis. So your knowledge of the law must have become particularly pertinent as the opposition to the operation gathered strength in certain countries that began to look for ways to prevent the disembarkment of refugees. Can you talk about your experience there? How did that change?
Yes, I can. As opposed to my own time on the Etna, which went quite smoothly because we were operating in that case with a partner jurisdiction, which was Italy, who accepted all migrants that were rescued by the Irish Naval Service to their ports without question. But during the course of Operation Sophia, when I was now the operational commander back in Ireland, but having the responsibility to oversee the operations of our ships while in the Mediterranean and conducting their work with Operation Sophia, we had a situation whereby one of our ships had rescued migrants. And there was a question as to whether Italy would continue to receive the migrants, and that had occurred because of a change of government. However, and this is a very important point of international law, and it's a credit to the civil servants in Ireland and the Irish government for ensuring that the correct legal procedures are in place before we commit a state asset to foreign jurisdiction. And that was that Ireland had entered into a bilateral with Italy, which Italy subsequently honoured when it was demonstrated to them that Ireland had this legal instrument in place. It was known as a nota verbale, and it had been agreed between the Irish and Italian governments. And so Ireland was able to overcome what had turned into a very large political football, I suggest, with the Italian government at the time. But Ireland managed again to thread the line very well in terms of being properly prepared before proceeding there. So that turned out to be a very, we'll say, positive and healthy experience throughout Ireland's involvement in Operation Sophia. But what we were witnessing, I would sum it up in lots of ways, but one of the things you're witnessing is, if we go back to the mass numbers of humanitarian migrants at sea requiring help, their lives would have been lost if the help did not exist in the form of a naval ship to rescue. Because of the mass numbers, states perhaps realized very early that we cannot have enormous disruption to trade and have an economic deficit as a result of disruption to trade by having the merchant ships conducting the rescue because of the scale of it. And so the state committed state assets to it, hence naval ships in the form of Operation Sophia. And over time, it came very clear to me, and this again, this would be my opinion, over time, you could see that which asset was perhaps best capable in this situation. And in terms of command and control, organization, coordination of assets, and the best execution of the rescues, I think the navies proved themselves extremely well there.
Yeah.
And that was a great, we'd say, outcome and learning outcome from the mission. But just to finish, I suppose, an answer to the overall question. The operation that we were dealing with had such a range of legality in terms of context surrounding it that the knowledge and experience that one would gain from our Irish education up to and including the LLM in Marine and Maritime Law was of tremendous value to the Irish Navy in terms of its operations in the Mediterranean.
It's good to hear.
I'm risking of going slightly off script here. Another question has just popped into my mind. How do you consider those private operations that have now stepped up the effort of rescuing refugees in the Mediterranean? What do you think of them? Are they filling the gap that's been left by naval services? Can they do it? Should they do it? Is it a sign for the Navy to step up again, for the navies? What's your opinion on those prior rescue operations?
Yeah, it's a very difficult question to answer. Again, if we stick with the overarching principle of saving human life, it seems that I think it's acceptable to say that overarches all other arguments. So I've worked with these non-governmental organizations, ships and volunteer organizations that proceed to the Mediterranean for this very purpose. And I certainly cannot say that what they are doing is wrong in any way whatsoever. But they are most certainly facing extraordinary challenges in terms of maritime law. And we, society, will learn a huge amount from this. Mm. Should court proceedings be taken against the actions, for example, of a captain proceeding into Lampedusa, even though being disobeying the orders of a warship, is going to be a very interesting case if that charge is brought. Carries an extraordinary sentence, and yet she was saving lives. So what it brings out, though, is, and I think this is understandable, a natural importance of ensuring that you have the legal status and the agreement to do what you're doing before you engage with it, because that smooths the overall operation at the end of the day. So there is an argument that by doing it without permissions and knowing where you're going to land these migrants, you have a protest card to play that, again, society will learn, and it represents the overall challenge to us all as how do we deal with this? Or should they stay away? I certainly can't argue that they should stay away when there are lives to be saved. Mm. So it really is a very difficult situation. But if we bring it all back to the overarching tension, which is the high seas is a place beyond jurisdiction. It is a place where freedoms exist. And we should not, I think, certainly at this stage, and there's nobody that I can see arguing for it, that will pass muster at the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, we should not curb or seek to curb the freedoms of the high seas. And therefore the challenge is for the coastal state jurisdiction to figure out the best way of dealing with these freedoms when they present on your doorstep in the form of a humanitarian situation. It's going to be a very interesting process going forward, but hopefully, and And I do think the policymakers have made some very astute decisions over time. Hopefully, no decisions will lead in unnecessary loss of life.
Moving on to another very difficult and also highly political topic. Looking ahead, what kind of challenges do you think Brexit will pose, for example, in the area of fishing rights between Ireland and the UK?
Brexit is going to present extraordinary challenges in terms of fishing rights. First of all, if you were to imagine Ireland and the UK in terms of exclusive economic zones only, so rather than look at the map of Ireland as the landmass and the map of Britain as the landmass, insert the 200-mile economic zone around both of them, and then extinguish the British one from the wider European map. And you will see that Ireland has the largest maritime border with a non-EU country, should the UK leave, in the entirety of the European Union. So we have huge jurisdictional border, extent of border with the UK. Secondly, notice when you extinguish the British EEZ from the European map, Ireland becomes completely isolated from the remainder of the European Union. So Ireland's exclusive economic zone does not touch off another European economic zone anywhere. So therefore we find ourselves as an independent country, but also a member of the European Union, completely cut off from the European Union in terms of fisheries jurisdiction. Now, the fish don't respect the jurisdictional line, and fishermen go where the fish are. So there is going to be a huge challenge in terms of enforcement, as overnight you will find, unless there has been agreements and arrangements in place, of which there are none yet, but overnight after Brexit, you will find the UK fishing fleet will be from a third country. They will not be part of the European Union, and therefore they will not be part of the common fisheries policy. So we're at sea enforcing the law under Irish law and also under the common fisheries policy on behalf of the European Union. And suddenly the entirety of the UK fleet will be from a third country. So that increases the enforcement challenge for us. And remember what I said earlier, that Ireland's fishing grounds are some of the best in the world, in fact, and therefore there's a huge interest in the fish and the fishing grounds on the west coast of Ireland, and southwest coast of Ireland in particular, by the UK fishing fleet. Add in another complication whereby the UK fishing fleet does not mean British crews. There is a huge number of fishing vessels from other countries who fish in other countries, but who are registered in the UK. And therefore they're flying a British flag, but they may be landing and fishing out of Spain and 100% crewed by Spanish crews. Yeah. So this is another complication, but one that I think that might be easily understood in terms of law enforcement, is that if a fishing vessel, which is a member of the European Union, chooses to land its fish in an Irish port, it's extremely commonplace. And what happens after that is the fish go through the regulatory check and the food standards, and then they proceed via land bridge by road in an articulated lorry across the Irish Sea, through Britain, across into the continent, into France, and then perhaps down to a Spanish market. This kind of operation is going to be massively disruptive, because a fishing vessel entering port to land its fish, who comes from a third country, must go through a far greater administrative process than a member of the European Union has to do so. And that administrative process will be significantly disrupted if it lands in the European Union, leaves the European Union to undertake a land bridge to go to back to the European Union again in France. So this is going to be a tremendous disruption to the supply lines. I think the Minister for Foreign Affairs has been quoted as using the term carnage in the fishing sector. Mm. It would be caused by Brexit. But the challenges for us in terms of fisheries law enforcement at sea, which is the Irish Naval Service's role on behalf of the state, is going to be extraordinary. And bear in mind, one other thing is that the Irish fishing fleet, fishing in UK waters, will now be a third country to the non-UK vessel coming in there. So there'll be enforcement on the UK. So this is going to be tremendous disruption in terms of traditional fishing rights. And that phrase, traditional fishing rights, bring me down to the smaller sector of just the very small inshore sector in terms of what was previously known as the voisinage agreement, where traditional rights, where we used to allow our neighbours fish closer to our shore, inside our territorial waters. All of that has got to be mapped out. All of that has got to be agreed. And jurisdiction lines have to be established. The Northern Ireland border extends into Lough Foyle, and the line isn't there. There isn't a jurisdictional line that runs down through Lough Foyle. So who owns the fish either side and so on? So the complications for this are huge. I think if the Minister of Foreign Affairs describes it as carnage, I don't need to go any further.
Mm. Lots of work for marine and maritime lawyers in Ireland.
There certainly is.
That's all we have time for on this episode. My thanks to Captain Fitzgerald for joining me today. Remember, if you enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can subscribe to future episodes by your podcast provider. And thanks again for listening.